Welcome to the Inferno Cast. Today's guest is a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but is also a world-class racquetball player. Please welcome Egan Inouye. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man, I'm glad to talk to you. I really appreciate you taking the time. You have an amazing story of coming up as a kid, accomplished so much in a lot of different things, and I really think there's going to be some good clues to success we can find in there. You know, maybe some lessons from mistakes, sure, too, I'm sure. I really wanted to go back to when you were a kid first of how did you discover martial arts and like what was the intrigue for you as a little guy?
So for me, I started off when I was four. My grandfather was a Shotokan karate instructor. So at four, I was already pushed into it. And, you know, I competed against all the 5-6-year-olds in the katas and kumites. So that was basically my start from when I was four.
That's awesome, man. So it's kind of a family affair. I'm just like, this is all that we know is, you know, we do martial arts and karate. There a transition in which you started trying to learn like other types of martial arts or different styles?
Yeah, totally. I mean, after that, you know, I was always interested in martial arts. And of course, that was the time of Bruce Lee, right? So I always, you know, I ventured on, you know, I got into, of course, Wing Chun. Got my blue shirt in Wing Chun. Then I did, you know, Jeet Kune Do, and I did Taekwondo. I got my black belt in Taekwondo and Hapkido. And, you know, and then I went to Judo. And then I got my brown belt in Judo. And, you know, I started studying Zen. And with the Zen instructor I was learning from, I also did Kendo. So I was doing Kendo for quite a while.
Man,
so and then, of course, cool. Jiu-Jitsu.
Of course, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Yeah. I mean, that's really like, I mean, but I used to hear the terms, you know, like you can't do mixed martial arts until you learn how to mix martial arts by having some experience in the multiple styles. When you were going through all of these styles, when you found BJJ, was it like so different that it just you attached to it, or was it kind of just the next evolution for you?
You know, it definitely opened my eyes. I mean, not to say, and I don't want to like insult anyone, but you know, all the other martial arts that I took, I mean, of course, there's bits and pieces that you can use in the martial arts, but compared to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, it was like, and the example was Ensign. He hasn't taken any of the martial arts. And he was like, hey, let's play. And he was only doing it for 3 months or so. And I just got, I mean, he annihilated me. I mean, imagine that, your younger brother, even if he was bigger, still, I mean, I felt so embarrassed. It was horrible. It was like the worst feeling when a jiu-jitsu guy gets a hold of you, right? And of course, I had the typical stand-up thought where, you can't touch me, I'm gonna knock you out. You can't take me to the ground. And I thought that over and over till finally I was like, if I did get to the ground, what happens, right? Because he kept getting me to the ground and there was no way I was gonna do anything. And there's a certain point where I realized, it's not gonna work, man. I should learn Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely like, I feel like that range of combat or, you know, like that area of the martial arts was just so neglected that it revolutionized, you know, hand-to-hand combat sport across the world. And you guys were kind of right there in the beginning, you know, as far as it spread to America and things of that nature. Yeah. What was it like kind of growing up watching this idea that you found grow into this mainstream worldwide phenomenon?
I know. I mean, it was amazing, right? Because when we were doing it, people didn't even know what it was. It was unbelievable. I mean, you know, even when Ensign was doing it, he showed me these articles and I was like, no big deal. And then it just started growing and growing. And I mean, now it's like unbelievably huge.
Yeah, it's definitely taken over. How do you feel the training differs from when you got started to how it is now?
You know, it's when I got started, I actually trained almost the exact same way. I do a lot of drills. And of course we did, you know, Ensign's theory was a lot of drills. So that's why I did a lot of drills. And I always wanted to like, okay, let's see if you can get me again, right? And of course, it's way more fun to roll, but you know, the injury rate goes up. And at that time I was playing racquetball and I couldn't jeopardize getting hurt. And I got hurt a couple of times doing jiu-jitsu. And so, you know, I realized that drills was the way to go to get better.
Right. Which, I mean, you were able to be the representative of what drilling can get you. I mean, you won ADC, you know, some ADCC matches against some very high-level competitors. I mean, because 99, you went against, I think, Henzo and, like, one on points. And then I think maybe it was the next year he went against Ricardo Laborio and, you know, won that match as well. Like, so when you look at these guys that want to do live roll all the time versus, you know, the drilling, the fundamentals, how do you explain to these younger athletes, like, how that success rate picks up, you know, in training methodology?
So, you know, I think, you know, the people who want to roll as a beginner, you're going to get hurt. It's just, this is how it's going to happen. You're going to get hurt. And anytime you have off, and, you know, as a professional athlete for most of my life, you know, that's the number one thing that takes people out of the game or sets you behind, and then you don't want to start again, right? So the thing is, I think when you get good enough, like, say, for example, like, if I roll with most blue belts and they're decent enough and they're kind of calm, I can get my drills done on them because I'm going to get the left arm lock. And I just keep doing it. And I coach them how to not get caught. And then I just keep doing it. And it's like drills. It's like live drills, right? And then I'll switch to something else. And, you know, for me, that's how I do drills with someone that, you know, really wants to roll. And, I mean, it's super frustrating for them, but super funny for me because I laugh the whole time, right? And, if, you know, drills, other than that, like, if you have someone way lesser than you or, you know, if it's like my wife, we can just do drills. I can do drills on her. I mean, she hates it because I'm heavier than her, right? But we can still get better together.
That's it. You know, and I've heard the story mentioned where I remember the story because the conversation was people were talking about Anderson Silva whenever he was, you know, on the top of his game years ago. And I remember this coach said, well, how do you think that Anderson Silva gets better if he's the best fighter in the world? And everybody kind of looked at him, you know, and then they brought up a story of Hickson. He said, look at Hickson, what he was having to do back in the day of when you're the best jiu-jitsu guy, how do you get better? And they brought up conditional situations. You put yourself in danger or you choose what you're going after and you have the discipline not to change the game. Like, I'm going to go armbar left side. Oh, well, maybe right side because it's right. So the degree of discipline you have to have, which brings me back to kind of your childhood coming up is – you started playing racquetball very young, right?
At 16.
Yeah, and then you were traveling the world being a professional player shortly after, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
With that degree of dedication and precision, how did that bleed over into training martial arts? Was it a direct correlation of I treat martial arts like I treat that, or was martial arts kind of an escape?
Actually, racquetball, I did it the exact same way as I did jiu-jitsu. You know, it was all about drills. I mean, everyone used to tell me, you're in Hawaii, you can't get good. You got to go to San Diego because at the time, San Diego was the mecca of racquetball. All the best racquetball players in the world were there, and they practiced with each other all the time. And I couldn't afford going out there all the time, so I figured that if I hit 1,000 shots every day and every different shot and get super precise, why couldn't I do that in a real match? You know, so it's the exact same like jiu-jitsu, right? And they always obviously have those numbers now. They're saying 10,000 times make you a master at it, right? Yeah. So I definitely hit over 10,000 shots in of each shot for sure.
Well, now, so when you're doing the drills, I mean, like the racquetball example, you know, you're doing the drills. How did you handle the emotional difference of being in the live match in front of the crowd? How did you make that bridge?
So that bridge is a tough bridge because now you're excited. You got people watching. You got people cheering. You got someone else in the court with you that's putting pressure on you. So basically the rest of the game is all in your mind. Like, you just got to be able to focus and you got to be able to slow yourself down and not get too excited, which was my problem. I was super impatient and I would get excited and I miss hit shots because I'm rushing, right? And it's the same errors that you'll make in a jiu-jitsu match or in an MMA fight. Same thing. You take that chance that you should never have taken because you got too excited.
How do you teach a beginner that without them? Do you think it's possible for somebody to kind of skip steps without the competitive experience to be like, oh, my first two competitions, I went out and performed excellently because I didn't have that emotional excitement and mistakes? Or is that a rite of passage? It's just like you have to walk through it.
I think, I mean, if you have never competed in anything in your life, it's going to be hard. I mean, I would doubt that someone would jump into a jiu-jitsu match unless they're sandbagging really bad. But, you know, even in front of a big crowd, it doesn't matter if you're sandbagging. You still might screw up, right? I mean, like, I had a student, and he was training me for a while, and he went to the, I think it was a purple belt Master Worlds. He's never entered a jiu-jitsu tournament in his life. He won Worlds first year. First tournament ever won Worlds, right? So I think it can happen, but this guy was also a super good competitive surfer. So competition was in his blood, you know. It's like, yeah, it's like a Kelly Slater. You put him in a jiu-jitsu tournament, he may win his first tournament.
Right. So there's that competitive advantage of performing under pressure, which, you know, they often say, like, an amateur can perform extremely well sometimes and a professional can perform well all the time.
Yeah.
Where it's the consistency. So when you're training athletes and jiu-jitsu players, do you kind of push on them like, man, competition, if you want to be a competitor, you need to do as many as possible? Or is that, or do you add on like some mental prep of like, here's what you can do to mentally prepare for it? Do you have any tools or hacks besides just doing the tournament?
So it depends on your personality. Some people need to just keep entering, you know, like, so like Barrett Yoshida, he wants to be in a competition every weekend. And, you know, the interesting about Barrett is he also has a way different training philosophy than everyone else does. You know, he puts in the work, he puts in the hours. I mean, he does, what, 50 10-minute rolls a day. I mean, imagine that. Like, of course you're going to be super good, right? And Barrett also says, I'm only going to do guillotines, or I'm only going to do triangles, or I'm only – and he'll just stick it out the whole day. And some days he may come up with no kills. And I know Barrett used to record all the amount of kills that he would have, right? And so I think each person is different. And just because you're a competitive person doesn't mean that you're going to do really good, because you need competition experience, whether in one sport or another sport. I mean, even like for myself, I entered maybe 3 tournaments before I won the Blue Belt World Championships. So I didn't have much tournament experience in jiu-jitsu, but I played, you know, 10 years of professional racquetball, and I've lost thousands of matches, and I, you know, came up on top 2 times, being the world champion in racketball 2 years in a row. And, well, actually not 2 years in a row, but 2 different times holding it for 2 years. So that same mentality moves into all the different sports.
Right. So it's almost like it's a trained skill that you have to work, just like, I mean, it's like a muscle group, you know, you got to keep working the muscle to make it stronger.
Yep.
How has that translated into the rest of your life? You know, what has happened outside of martial arts and racquetball that you look at and you're like, this is a reflection of the discipline or what I've learned from doing martial arts my whole life?
So I think, like, for example, like for me, what I notice is, like, basically everything I do, I always have a goal, just like in martial arts or jiu-jitsu or whatever it is, right? And then I figure out the process. So what are the steps? So I reverse engineer it. Like, how am I going to get to be good at it? This is all the steps I have to do. And those steps, if I really want it bad, it's a non-negotiable. And that's what I did with all my sports. That's what I do with business. That's what I do with, now it's foil boarding. And it's funny because so many people I run into always go, Ian, man, everything you do is, you're just like a gifted athlete. But they don't see all the steps that I've taken. They don't understand the process of the mind and how much I work on it, you know? And I mean, like, foil boarding now, you know, I'm pretty good at foil boarding, and people are like, oh my gosh, how do you get so good so fast? And it's not fast. It's just trying to get a little bit better every single day, you know, and spending that little bit of time. And, you know, a lot of people, like, if you're a kid, you can spend a lot of time because you got nothing else. But then when you got a family to raise, you have limited amount of time. So, like, a lot of my friends or the guys I foil board with, they'll stay out for 4 or 5 hours. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, if I could, I would. But I got an hour and a half maybe every other day or every day, right now every day. And I mean, this, that hour and a half, I know exactly what I'm trying to do in that hour and a half. I'm either working on turns, I'm working on pumping, I'm working on something, right? And it's always, I already know by the time I get out what I want to work on. And I think that's super important.
Yeah, is a prioritization of steps that yield the best results, which you have to probably have a little bit of a analytical mind to measure and discern what's important, which I'm sure the longer you're an athlete, the better you get at that as it bleeds over into other things where you can identify, like, the key factors faster, I would assume.
Yeah, I think it's important. But I mean, like, if you're a natural gifted athlete and you became the top of your whatever sport it is, you rarely see those guys change to another sport and do the same thing, and change to another sport and do the same thing, you know, because they don't have a process. They were so naturally gifted.
It's almost like it was too easy and they didn't have to structure it to work past, like, the resistance of the struggle, to where they just kind of ended up there and it's cool and they embrace it and they do that. but they don't know how to recreate the process.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I'm sure as a coach, that's probably what makes you such a good coach, is because you've had to structurally recreate it for yourself so many times, and now you create it for your students to where you become like this master architect for success in certain things, right?
Yeah, and it's totally true, because I've gone through all of those steps. Like, say, man, like, say for example, with racquetball, they used to always say I had all the skills, I had everything, but I couldn't win. Like, what the heck? Egan's like a fighter pilot jet. And the pilot doesn't know what to shoot. Like, I use the machine guns when I should be bombing or using missiles. Or I'm using missiles when I should be using the machine gun, right? And so one of my coaches broke that down to me and goes, Egan, if you had to screw in a screw, would you use a hammer? I'm like, no, I'd use a screwdriver. He goes, yeah, okay, so if you had to put in a nail, would you try to use your screwdriver or would you use a hammer? And I go, I'd use a hammer. He goes, okay, do the same thing for racquetball. And it's the same thing for jiu-jitsu and MMA. Everyone always asks, what is your favorite technique? And my answer is always, whatever technique fits perfect for that opportunity or that moment, right? Because you can do it for practice where you just only hunt for right arm locks or left arm locks or triangles. But in a tournament situation, if you're going to be that way, you're not going to be successful.
Right. You got to – and that's where, like, in judo, do you remember the term fit in? Like whenever you do a fit in for a throw, it's almost like that's what you're having to train your brain to do live when you're in like a jiu-jitsu tournament, you know, or even a judo tournament. Like you have to see the fit in before the opportunity is there. So totally. That, you know, you can evaluate it. How do you feel like people can develop that ability faster? Because it's almost a little bit visuospatial, you know, like it's experience, it's technique. How do you think people can develop that a little bit quicker?
So usually, like in my school, what I try to do to develop that in my students is it's a scenario thing. Like you teach them this technique, you teach them this technique. How do you merge those techniques and see how many times you can go back and forth? And then I feel like they can start seeing like the super easy example would be like from a triangle to an arm lock. You know, at a certain point, you're not going to get that triangle. But if you wait too long, you're going to miss even the arm lock. So when do you make that transition? Right. And so that's the kind of thing that I try to work on with people. And, you know, even with sweeps, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. You try for this sweep, it opens up another sweep. And, I mean, that's what I love so much about jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, it's like it's the never-ending option where it's like counter for counter, which counter. And there's a lot of martial arts that are that way, but I feel like a lot of the other realistic martial arts that way, there's almost like a shelf life of there's only so many years in your life you can perform at that level. You know, I mean, like with boxing and kickboxing, like, you know, so many shots before it's like, okay, I've got, you know, concussions and, you know, like with judo with the big throws, I mean, you know, you take the falls right, you have good mats, but still it's just like, as you kind of get a little bit more miles on the vehicle. And I feel like the BJJ almost has a unique piece where you can keep that speed and acceleration so close to live play pretty consistently. Whenever you look at athletics as an overall performance sport and you run into that person that doesn't see things the way you see it, they don't understand the reverse engineering, you know, the 1,000 reps, and they're like, well, I'm just not any good at it. How do you speak and inspire that person?
So usually, like, for example, if it's jiu-jitsu, I mean, I work with all different kinds of athletes because every sport to me is so similar. There's so much things that exactly, like, it's like, you know, like I train a golfer and everyone's like, what? Egan plays golf? Nope. Egan doesn't play golf. Right. And you know, the person that I train, they said, it's the funnest thing to tell people. Yeah, I got Egan to know. And they're like, what? He's a martial arts guy. He plays golf. And she goes, no. And she goes, you should see the look on their face. They're like, what? How is he working with you? And it's, you know, body mechanics, mental things, under stress, how do you function? Right. So for me to explain it to someone that doesn't get it, it's, if it's in jiu-jitsu, oops, sorry. Let me get rid of this call. Caleb, are you there? Sorry, someone just called. Okay, so basically, the way I see it is, if it's jiu-jitsu, it's way easier for me to teach it because we'll get in a roll, and I'll slow the roll down, and I'll set it up step by step, and I'll say, I'm gonna get you in a triangle, say, and then I'll, you know, do say like a hip bump, a hip throw. He pulls his hand down, and I get it to a triangle. right? And I say, I can see, I'm setting these things up way ahead of time. And then I do little things just like that example. And then pretty soon they're like, oh my gosh, so you know exactly what you're going to do before we get there. I said, exactly. Everything has a right and a left, right? Everything has, everything that you do, if this sweep doesn't work, this sweep works. And so I'll play with that. Now he'll protect from this one sweep and then he falls for the next sweep. And so I'll just keep doing things back and forth until like they start going, oh my gosh. So there's, it's not all about muscle and strength and I want to do this and I'm going to do this right now. It's not like that. I said, I want to do this. It might take me 4 steps to get there, but I'm going to get there. And, but that's my plan. It's the same thing. Like you want to be a world champ. These are the steps that you have to take to be a world champ. You might take 10 steps to get there. You might take 6. And it's all depending on your luck.
Yeah. And it's definitely going to be more than 1 step.
Guaranteed.
It's definitely going to be more than one.
Yeah.
So you look at this chaining principle. Do you feel like it's more for the physical muscle memory, or do you feel that it leans more for the like psychological skill of seeing things in deeper steps?
I think it's both. I think, you know, the really good guys, they feel it. They feel it coming right away. They don't even need to see it. In their head, they have an image of where they want to go, but their body knows already. It's like, oh, like, you know, as you get better in jiu-jitsu, you already start feeling, you know what's coming. You know what? I mean, even like when I roll with a guy way better than me, it's like, I feel it coming already. I know what he wants, right? So I know I'm going to get away a couple times, but he's going to catch me at some point. And right. Usually I get caught if it's something that I never saw before. If it's something that I know, it's really hard to get me on something, but it's some little trick that you designed by yourself that hasn't been out there, then you might catch me once, right? But the second time, try to catch me again. It's going to be even, you're going to take even more steps to get me. And you know that for me, jiu-jitsu, that's what I love. I mean, I can do that to people. Then I can run into guys that can do that to me. And I'm like, I'm stoked being on the opposite side. You know, I'm like, wow, this is like my brain. It's just, you know, testing my brain, keeping me sharp. And yeah. That's the great thing about bringing up younger kids with the right philosophy that understand that. And I don't need to worry about getting hurt.
Right. And that's another thing is like, how do you set that philosophy in these younger athletes? Because when you walk on the mat and you're a white belt, what you think success is versus what success really is are two very different things. So how do you, first, how do you define what they think success is versus what it really is? And then how do you connect that idea?
So I know it's really hard for that success part because I get a lot of younger guys that come in and like the first thing I do is I just never roll with them. So I kind of throw in some old school martial arts stuff. And not too long ago, one of the guys was like, hey, when I first came to the school, man, I thought you're like, you acted like you're too cool for anybody. And I said, no, I said, it's more, you know, that you got to earn your right, you know, and I'll watch you and I'll let you train with other people and I'll see how your progress is. And whoever you're starting to train with, I'll always have conversations with that person because I'm rolling with that person too, right? And I tell them what, you know, if I see you doing something different, I'll have that done. And of course, when I'm teaching class, if they're in my class, I make sure they follow the steps. And, you know, for some of the younger guys, it's so hard. They want to get rolling right away. I say, no, 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 no. And I just bring them back and bring them back. And I kind of see in their face, like this is horrible. I don't want to, this sucks. Right. And I'll explain to them, you know, it sucks, but you know, if you can't do it like this, you're not going to do it live. I guarantee right. you. And then if I still see that disbelief at the end of the session, I'll set them up with one of the other younger guys that would just tool them and just say, okay, what we just drilled is going to happen to you in a live role. You do whatever you want and watch, you know, this guy's going to catch you with it. And it happens over and over and over. And I just keep them going until that person's like, all right, I got it. I don't want to roll no more. This is not fun anymore. Right. So that's usually how I do it. Like kind of old school style, right? You get pounded on the head, you finally learn.
Well, I mean, it's like they believe that this is the fastest path and they haven't had the experience to realize that that's incorrect. And you're just mm-hmm. giving them that experience. And I think mm-hmm. it's smart that you're using other athletes too, because if you do it to them, it makes sense and they want more because it's like, well, of course, sensei can get me, you know, of course.
yeah,
he's a ninja. I just need more of that to make me better. But yeah. When it's like, oh, here's one of the other guys, you know, that's a solid purple belt, has been training for the last 6-7 years, and he just beats him like a drum. Uh-huh. And it's like, oh, okay, so it's not magic, you know. It can be defeated, and there's a structure here that mm-hmm. that I need to be paying attention to. You know, I think that's a smart approach. And like you said, it depends on the athlete, because I'm sure you get athletes on the other end that are the opposite, that, you know, they're fearful, they're afraid of rolling, afraid yeah. of getting hurt, and, you know, and they're real apprehensive. How do you help people come out of their shell?
So the ones that are the opposite way usually are like the professionals. So like for me and in my school, it's the doctors and the, you know, and the dentists that they can't afford to get hurt. So they're like super nervous about it. And like, oh man, I can't, you know? And so with those guys, I always have them roll with higher belts. And then let it, you know, and the higher belts, you know, once you get to a higher belt, you know how good you are. So you don't have that ego. And you get submitted and you get submitted. And I, you know, with my private lessons, same thing. And it's really funny because, you know, a lot of my private lessons, they'll get me in an arm lock and they'll go off telephone. Oh, I got Egan today in the arm lock, right? And for me, it doesn't bother me. But like some of the other students, like, oh my gosh, you know, I thought that at one point. And you don't understand how dumb you sound, right? Or yeah. I almost had Egan, but oh, or I let him go or whatever. And they're like, yeah, right.
But you know, and that's so smart as a coach, though, because you're empowering them to know like what it's supposed to feel like. And yep. you know, short story, like I talked to, you know, one of your students, Alex, and he said that the turning point for him in jiu-jitsu was when you let him get you in a cross choke and you corrected it and you got it all locked in. And he's like, in that moment, he's like, I knew that I could finish this choke. You know, like he put me there. It wasn't like he earned it, but he's like, that's when I felt the power of jiu-jitsu. It was like, man, like I could just tighten this up. There's like nothing anybody could do. You know, so like those moments, you're giving mm-hmm. those moments to students.
Yep. Yeah. I think that's how you get them out of their shell, right? And I know, like, I remember when I remember that exact instance that Alex told you, because after I tapped, he was like, you could have escaped that. I go, no way. He was really, I go, you try to escape it. So I did it back to him and he was like, I go, that's how I feel. That's exactly how, that's what you did to me. And then I think that moment, like he said, that's when it was like, wow, if I get to this position, I finish anybody.
Yeah. You know, and that goes back to like what you explained the first time of like the setup, step one, step two, step three. So, you know, you are a structured analytical person that understands the power of repetition. Do you feel like you were born with this, or was there a moment or something in your life that kind of like helped you understand this? Like, was it ingrained in you? Was it a learned skill? Like, how did you become this comprehensive of success principles?
I don't think I was born with it. I mean, I was born a little hard-headed, and it was the wrong way. Like, don't do this, Egan, and I do it again, and I do it again, and I keep doing it wrong. But I think what happened was there, you know, my dad used to always point out the great athletes. And I used to study them. From when I was young, I would just like look for whatever books I could or anybody that's like the top in their sport. And I would find the common threads. And one of the common threads was they spent a lot of time working on their skill, whether it's basketball, shooting lots of free throws, or you know, baseball players or football players. There's tons of stories about these guys coming out before practice, before everyone else, and then they leave after everyone else, right? And those are the stories that inspired me, because they're the ones who are doing it over and over. And because I wasn't such a gifted athlete where, you know, when I went out to play baseball, I wasn't the best baseball player for a couple of years, but then I became the best batter. And then I became one of the best pitchers and, you know, and catcher and whatever, you know, whatever position they threw me into, I became one of the best, right? And it was because I do it over and I do it over and I do it over. Batting practice over and over. I get home, I hit the tire over and over. I spend hours. And then that's when I learned, by the time I got to racquetball, I kind of had that idea that if I spent hours and hours just doing one thing, mastering one thing at a time, you know, in 365 days, if I just get that much better, I'm gonna be good in 1 year.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I've met and I've also been a piece of that person where the stubbornness is like going the wrong direction. You know, it's yeah. like, hey, you know, this is not how you get successful with this. You know, that's not the way to work. And you're like, oh yeah, watch this. And I feel like a lot of people even outside of athletics, they feel like they get caught up in that where like they just have to learn the hard way.
Yeah.
How did you steer it the other direction? I mean, was it from completely modeling, or was there a little bit of a epiphany that happened that was like, man, there's got to be a better way, you know, because I'm sure it had to have trickled over into things other than sports, of just like the stubborn, hard-headed, taking the wrong direction, you know, where how did that transition happen for you personally?
I think from what I learned growing up, I mean, you know, and becoming successful at things. I mean, a good example is like I go to these mastermind things where we pay, you know, a good $1,000, $2,000 a month to be part of this mastermind. And I go to these meetings and they tell you, this is what you got to do. What did you do from the last meeting? Here, these are all the things that I've done. And they go, okay, here's your next marching orders. These are the next things you got to get done. And for me, it's like, yes, sir, I'm on it. Right. And then I see people in there going, yeah, but this and but that and but this. And I'm going, really? You just spent $2,000. You pay $2,000 a month to get to work with these masterminds who obviously know, otherwise we wouldn't be paying this kind of money. Why are you doubting them? Why are you questioning them? Just do what they say. You know, and I see it all the time. And I think to myself, like, oh my gosh, when are these guys gonna get it? And I think, you know, that stubbornness is good for certain things. Stubbornness as in grit is really good. And like, you know, like for example, stubbornness where people is like, Egan, you're not going to make it in racquetball. You live in Hawaii. Oh yeah, I'll show you. I mean, yeah. Something like that is healthy. Or when I was doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I'm like, man, I would love to be a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world champion. And everyone in Hawaii would be like, you know why they call it Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? And I'm like, why? Because they're the best in the world, and there's nobody that's ever won a world title in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu except Brazilians. And I like, wow, okay, watch me. You know, and that's the kind of, to me, that type of stubbornness is okay. Yeah. But then when it's coming to marching orders or working on process, to be a buck, like to not do it the way it was set up to be done right. And, you know, until you get really good at it, then you can start making up your own processes. But right. In certain things, like say, for example, that I don't know in business and I hire, you know, someone to teach me, I'm not going to make up my own process. I'm going to follow his process because obviously he was successful at it. And of course, you always want to get someone that's successful in it and has done it to coach you, because I really believe that, you know, you're not going to go to a dentist that has holes in his teeth or missing all his teeth, right? Or you're not going to go to a hairstylist that got a crooked haircut or funny ripped up colors, right? Or it's yeah. The same thing. Same thing.
You know, it's funny that you use those examples, because I had a friend that's a car mechanic, and he's like, you know, I spot a good mechanic because his stuff is always not running because he's working on everybody else's stuff. Like, that's the one anomaly where it's all like, a good mechanic's car never runs right. <You're too busy. laughs> So where do you feel like that reluctance to follow the marching orders comes from in people, especially like in a martial arts industry, you know, a lot of pride, a lot of ego, you know, like where do you feel like that comes from when people are just like, well, I just don't want to do it that way, whenever their way is not working?
Yeah, I think it's just the humbleness. They don't have that. They don't have that, they don't have it in them to be humble about it, you know? And I think it's a human fault. And some people just, they're not going to get better. They're just not going to. I mean, for example, like I like to keep challenging myself. And like, say, I was good enough in surfing where I could surf the rest of my life and be good. And then this foil boarding comes along and it's this whole different thing. And then you try it out and you're going to take cracks like you've never taken before. I mean, it's tough, right? Most guys will quit and they're like, Trick, I'm going to go back to surfing, because they got that ego. Like, I'm a good surfer. I don't want to look stupid doing this, you know, whereas myself and the guys I hang around with is like, yeah, let's do this. Let's try it. And, you know, we get really happy with small little successes. Like, oh, we got to fly for a second. We got the board off the water. Oh yeah. You know, and that little thing. And then you start in your head, you start analyzing. And for me, I start analyzing, and I, when we're waiting for waves, I talk about it to my friends and they're like, oh, you think? And I'm like, yeah, I think, try. Let me know what you think. And then they'll do something, and, you know, pretty soon we're all flying, man.
Yeah. I mean, and now just even in the jiu-jitsu world, like, it's kind of the same thing. Whenever somebody pulls something off and you kind of, you know, deconstruct it and you communicate about it and talk about it, and then you start noticing it's the details that you really start looking for. That's like, I don't need the new move. I just need to know, like, where did your hand go? Like, thumb in, thumb out, like this. Yeah. That. You fall in love with the details, but then you got to find a way to muscle memory train the details. Mm-hmm. Do you find it difficult to still drill this many years later something super fundamental as easy as it was when you kind of hit, you know, it was a little bit earlier in the beginning where there's more newness? Like, do you still feel the same amount of like, no, I need to hit my 1,000 reps of drill? Or are you kind of like, well, I can hit it, like you said, conditional rolls with blue belts. Has it adjusted as you get more experience and more successful in jiu-jitsu?
You know, what's really funny is sometimes I'm teaching and we do arm lock drills. And I haven't done it for a long time. And then when I do it, I'm like, whoa, I'm not that good at it anymore, right? I mean, I'll catch it in a roll. But when I do the drills, it's not as smooth. I got a lot of rough edges. And the thing that I think in my head is like, I understand that, so I don't get frustrated about it. And I understand that if I don't do the drills, I'm not going to be as sharp. And that's just how it is. So if I don't spend the time doing my drills, I need to know that I got to be okay, that I'm going to miss it sometimes. And I'm not going to be as smooth, right? And I think if you think in those terms, I think you continue to get better, because for me, if I want to get better again, I'll go back to those basics and make sure they're smooth.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on visualization as far as a supplementary training to the physical?
I think visualization is the key. I mean, it's been for me from racquetball days, you know, and obviously you can visualize. And when you get out to the real world or you try it for real, it doesn't work. But then you keep doing it. And visualization isn't just visual in your head. You got to start being able to feel it. You got to start being able to smell it, to where the point where as you're visualizing, you can feel your shoulder moving and the other shoulder moving. And you just start feeling it. Then you understand it. And you know it's ingrained in your body, right? So visualization is huge.
Is there anything you specifically do to like feed your brain as far as like books, you know, documentaries? Is there anything very specific that you're like, this is what keeps me on the edge?
I think for me, it's my wife reads a lot. So she's always like, Egan, you got to read this book and you got to read this book. And like, for me, I don't really like reading. Thank goodness there's like, you can listen to books now, right? So you can go audio books. So for me, it's audio books, and it really pumps my brain. And, you know, I teach boot camp. So I tell a lot of stories in boot camp to inspire people, because that's kind of like my passion now. I love it when people get that aha moment, or I just lost 10 pounds, or I can do a push-up now, you know? And so a lot of my stories are inspiring. So for me to get those things, I got to keep learning and I got to keep getting better, because there's a lot of experience that I had in my life that if I can relate it to a great quote or a learning lesson, everybody else had those same lessons in their life. They just haven't spotted it yet. And so sometimes when I tell my stories, people be like, oh my gosh, I had something just like that. I get it. And then they use those experiences as strengths in their life. And to me, that's what I like to do. And I think that's why I keep growing. I'm always listening to podcasts. And, you know, I still, any great athlete that comes along that all of a sudden it's like, whoa, this guy's unbelievable. I go ahead and now we got the internet, super easy. I research him and I look, what did this guy do? Did he do something different than everyone else? And it's usually not. But they always have one little thing that they say that I'm like, oh, I'm going to use that next time. I like that. I like the way they made that relationship or that analogy.
Yeah. So how do you help people discern the difference between a little bit of motivation and finding their drive?
So I always say motivation is temporary, right? I can motivate you and you can be motivated for a little while. But my key is to try to inspire you. Because when I inspire you and you become inspired, now you're going to have your drive, right? Now you got to drive because you're inspired now. And, you know, as far as having drive to be, say, the best in the world, that's not for everyone. But if I can get you to have that, inspire you to have that drive to work out every single day, I always tell them, don't worry about losing that weight or getting back in shape. If you can just work out every single day, you're going to get there.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it goes back to what you've been preaching this entire time, is just that consistency factor, mm-hmm. You know, like just having to do it over and over. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the 10,000 reps rule and things of that mm-hmm. nature. How important is it to you of the degrees of correctness? So there's kind of two theories of thought where it's like, one is we're going to do everything precise down to 100% correct on day one, even no matter how slow it takes. Or there's another theory where it's like degrees of correctness of like, you're in the ballpark, do more of it. You're in the ballpark, do more of it. Which one of those do you adhere to, or some kind of mix of the two?
You know what? I lean more toward like, you just work on one thing at a time. Because I find that, like, especially in like boot camp situations where people are trying to get in shape, if I say you got to stick in this diet, you got to work out every single day, you got to make sure you stretch, you got to do this, this, and this, and this, they're going to get there. It's overload. Instead of like, hey, how about you start drinking, you know, 3 liters of water every day? That's it. What? That's it. No, that got to be more than that. No, no, no. That's all you got to do. Now that you're working out every single day or 3 times a week, now let's try to drink 3 liters of water. That's it. Simple. I can do that. And that's the way I even jujitsu, even like an arm lock, I don't try to correct it perfect. I show them the perfect way. I get them to the perfect position. And this is what we're working on. The hip shift, the hip shift, the hip shift. Don't worry about the rest. It's going to come, you know, shoulder trap, from there, the shoulder trap, and just break it down little by little. And I feel like that way, nobody gets discouraged along the way.
Right. You're helping people feel successful at doing something, even though they're not, you know, the most successful person, but they're feeling success because it's better than it was. And like you said, it's something small that they can kind of measure. It's like you're getting the hang of it. Because especially the new culture, especially with jiu-jitsu, it's like you need to be grappling other white belts in 3 months to see how good you are. Now you need to grapple another blue belt that, you know, against your blue belt, you just got to see how good you are. Like with that culture of martial arts coming up, because there's some learning theories that come from a mastery mindset of like, you don't need to be worried about how you do against other people for like 7 or 8 years because they're looking at a lifelong journey. But then you flip side and it's like, yeah, people want to go to tournaments. They want to have fun. How do you balance that, you know, as far as feeding them to where they're able to be successful at kind of both?
So usually when someone comes into their jiu-jitsu journey, I usually just try to make small victories for them. And not even make it like against anyone else, or you're just trying to get this and you're trying to get that. And I always tell them that, you know, that movement was great. That was great. And I try to structure it where what you just did is great and not that, oh, you got arm lock, you won, you beat that guy. That's great. That's not that important to me if you beat that guy. And I really try to emphasize that in my school because I don't want anyone getting hurt. And my clientele is older. And so I really want them to be more helpful with each other and leave that ego at the door. And one of the ways is your success today. You can submit this guy all the time. So what's the big deal? Your goal should be being able to do something to them that they have no idea that you just did it. And if you can achieve something like that and make sure that that guy is still pumped about jiu-jitsu after you did all this stuff to him, now you're getting good. Now you're getting successful. Yeah. You know, and I always tell people too, I it drives me nuts when someone does something that's good and they go, oh, that's awesome. I say, don't tell anyone that anything's awesome because I'm not even awesome. Like you can't, the awesome is the goal and you're not going to get there. And it's cool. It's cool. And I don't want anyone to get into that overpraise thing because once that starts to happen, then people want to quit because it becomes frustrating a lot faster. Right. Where that was good. That was not bad. Oh, that was great. That was really great. Wow. You know, and when
you can't keep moving that bar, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And in tournaments, I praise them that they won the tournament, but I'd rather go to each match and show them all the great things that they did along the way and not even talk about the win or lose, you know, and it's great for the school that, hey, Grappling Unlimited or Iginonoi Jiu-Jitsu just got 10 gold medals. I don't even want the guys to worry about that. All I want the guys to worry about is to do what you practice.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that's an important thing as a coach too, to figure out the value system you want your students to have, because if you get too focused on competition, then the students start only feeling as good as they were in the last tournament or only as good as other people did in the last tournament. You know, and whenever you have a lot of people that are already questioning themselves and have self-image problems or, you know, self-esteem issues, you know, they start measuring the wrong things that can really affect their journey in a negative way. I feel like that's a lot of foresight that you have there. It's kind of like adjusting the bar where it's like, you're a white belt. You don't get to be awesome yet. We're not
yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Keeping your people humble. You know, and that brings me to an interesting question is, so a lot of people, they try to be humble, and in being so humble, they kind of take away some of their confidence a little bit sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you help people balance that of, you know, be humble, but still be confident in who you are and what you know you can achieve?
Yep. So growing up, like, and you know, in the Asian culture, it's always like that. Like, say, for example, the ladies cook a good meal and you go, oh, that was a great, good meal, right? If you go to Japan and you tell a lady, wow, that was a great meal, they go, oh no, that was no good, that was junk, you know, and they always put themselves down. And I grew up that way. I mean, everything I did, it was like, wasn't good enough. And you know, that can destroy your self-confidence, right? And for me, that fine line I had to learn. Like, I tried being cocky when I was playing racquetball, and then, you know, I try to follow the cocky guys, and that didn't really work for me because it wasn't in my nature. So like, if it's not in your nature, you can't do it that way. That's one thing. And the other thing is, my dad used to tell me this. He goes, Egan, you know what? You're a champion right now. You're the world champ. You're the racquetball world champion. If you be cocky right now, when there's another champion, everyone's going to love them, and they're going to forget about you. But if you're graceful and you're a humble champion, they're going to remember you forever. And like, that really stuck into my head. And then I started learning, like, what is humble? You can still be confident when you're humble, right? So basically, when I before like any tournament, of course I'm planning to win. I'm expecting myself to win, no doubt about it. But I'm not going to tell you like I'm going to win because I'm the greatest I ever played, right? And I watch Muhammad Ali and I love it. And, you know, I love that. But what I used to like is, like, I used to watch Mike Tyson before his fights. I mean, he had nothing to say. And then he'd go into the ring and just wreck house, you know? And I thought to myself, man, that's the athlete I want to be, where people look at you and like, eh. And, you know, that's what jiu-jitsu is about, too. You look at jiu-jitsu guys on the street and you think, what is that guy going to do to me? And then he'd twist you up and make you feel like, whoa, man, what the heck just happened, right? Or you get a girl. And I used to love this. Like, guys would come in, like, all big, muscular guys. And then I have one of our good blue belt girls go and wrestle with him. And, you know, the guy's strong, so he's going to hold her off for a little bit. But sooner or later, right? And, you know, that's how I teach humbleness. And I keep people on the street going, you never know who you're going to run into. You know, so yeah. Don't be that one, you know. And I think the confidence, it's more confidence. Like, for me, instead of needing to be cocky to get confidence, I always went back into my training. So I know I worked hard. I knew I covered every base of my training. I knew I did everything in my process. I got to win. I'm going to win. And if I didn't win, what did I do wrong? Or where can I get better next time? You know, and that's always how I act. And, you know, I've been lucky. I've won a lot of good matches. I mean, beating Hansel Gracie and Ricardo Laborio. I mean, that I never even dreamt of beating these two guys. I mean, these two guys are my heroes, my mentors. I mean, I love those two guys. Even till today, I mean, these guys are great. And I still, in my head, go, oh my gosh, I can't believe I beat these guys, man. How the heck did I do that? You know, and I think it was just, you know, I get lucky, or I played the game exactly right. I figured out my strategy. I stuck to that strategy and I did it, you know, and lucky for me.
Yeah. I mean, and those are moments in time, and that's what you hear these people talk about that achieve at high levels, just like yourself. That's like, you would probably be one of the first people to win a world champion and still be like, well, yeah, today in this mm-hmm. moment, but tonight, or, you know, tomorrow it changes. And that's where it goes back to that pursuit of the impossible. You know, because you yep. will never be the absolute best all the time. Yeah, you know, yep. it'll never happen. But that's the pursuit of it. And you value the people that are there with you because they're helping you chase that, you know, yep. because you know after that match, Hinzo's like, man, I not again. That, you know, like, you know, it affects him that way. Just like for you, there's probably a time yep. or something where you came up short on one and you're like, man, I'm going to work tomorrow at the gym. I'm going to fix that. yeah. It's not happening again. And you yeah. guys sharpen each other, you know, that mm-hmm. old iron sharpens iron thing, you know, just you guys sharpen each other for the pursuit of excellence. And yep. I mean, and that's something that you have multiple clues for in your life, of just the different sports and your different achievements. And you're always trying to do something new and different and just test yep. the limits of what you're doing. And I just always wonder, you know, has it inhibited you being a coach for people that are not wired that way? Because I know for me, sometimes I struggle if I don't identify with somebody, you know, extremely.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
I have to learn more skills. Did it take you a long time to get those skills to connect with people that weren't wired the way you are?
You know, it frustrates me a little bit, but I feel like when the person's not humble, it's easy to break them down. You know, especially in jujitsu. I mean, when you do the same thing to them over and over and over, and if they're a cocky person, I will start talking a little crap to them and go, really? I just told you what I'm going to do. Seriously, you can't stop me? You're bigger than, if they're bigger and stronger, I go, look, you're bigger and stronger. You still can't do anything. You know, and you just try to break them down and break them down and break them down, you know, and I usually can tell those people right away. Like, for example, if they're one of my students and say, like, when I beat Hensel, oh, man, you're better than Hensel. I'm not better than Hensel. Not at all. What do you mean you're not better than Hensel? You just beat him in ADCC. I'm like, that doesn't mean I'm better. I beat him that day. But I still consider Hensel a better jiu-jitsu man than I am. Same with Ricardo Laborio. Till today, I feel like like Hensel was here this past year, like 3-4 months ago. Man, I freaking learn from Hensel again. And I tell Hensel, man, oh my gosh, you know. I mean, he's such a good teacher. And I'm sure if I ever ran into Ricardo again, I'd learn something from him too. And I'll never, ever consider myself better than any of those guys.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference of the younger generation and, like, you know, the juvenile age of where it's like it's a measurement of who's better. But when you start getting up to that echelon, like, none of the guys really look at it that way. As far as, like, it's an expression of their art and their style, and they know that it's momentarily, you know, like, it's just that moment just to kind of make each other better, and things happen. And because I've talked to, like, Ricardo's a friend that I've talked to, you know, many times, and he always carries the same attitude that you do. Even like Carlos Machado, like, he's always just been so humble and so gracious with his time to help. And I'm all the time like, how do you remember my name? You know, like 15, 20 years later, I'm just like, I'm a nobody in the world as far as in relation to this. And he's always so gracious and helpful. And a lot of the greats are because they see that bigger picture.
Yeah.
That, you know, like when you're younger, it's like, yeah, let's have a fight. Let's see who's tougher. Yeah. Just like for me, when I got into MMA as a teenager, you know, it was like, it was to show everybody how tough I was. You know, look what I could do. It was definitely for some of the wrong reasons of trying to prove it in myself that I had this value. But then it didn't take long before it transitioned into something else that was like, no, it was like, you know, kind of the bravado and showing and stuff like that. So what you're saying makes total sense, you know, especially from a high achiever perspective, is you guys are peers and it's building the industry and the community to make each other better. Not pushing each other down, you know, and I feel like that's probably come into your school and your culture a lot too.
I mean, if you came to our school and rolled, you'd be like, wow, every single guy that you have here, super cool, super fun to roll with, you know, and that's just how it is. I feel like when you're overconfident, when you lose, you're broken. A lot of times you're broken. Like, whereas if you're a humble person, when you lose, it's easy. It's like, hey, he was better than me today. Because it's not about who's better who's better forever. It's just on that day, you felt better than I did, or I felt better than you did, and I got lucky today. And that's the way I carry it. And that way, when I do lose, let's figure out why I lost. No big deal.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't define you. And I think that goes back to, like, whenever people fall in love with the idea that they're trying to achieve, you know, the medal, the podium, what this will mean, what that belt will mean. And they fall in love with with what they're going to get, and they miss out on the journey in between. And that's really an unfulfilling path of life.
Yeah.
Because once you get it, you know, now what? And I think a lot of people struggle with that, especially athletes, because, you know, a lot of athletes are very achieving focused, where it's like, I achieved to get attention and appreciation and self-worth. And if you're too much on that side of it, you know, it can be very unfulfilling, because then your value is only a reflection of what you last achieved. You know, so how do you coach athletes that are maybe a little bit too far on that end, where it's not arrogance, you know, it's not this, you know, cocky attitude. It's just this drive of like, no, I have to do well to be okay. How do you pull them back from that to get them to see what's really important?
You know, I the way I pull them back is you just bring them back to where this is, you know, bring them back to simple goals and being happy about just hitting these simple goals. right? And I feel like just having those little tiny goals again and that process and just being happy with that and don't worry about the outcome, because the outcome's going to happen. It's going to happen just how you want it, as long as you take these little victories along the way and keep yourself happy. Because part of this whole journey is if you're not happy and you're grouchy and you're upset all the time, this becomes no fun at all. And I feel like there's got to be some fun in it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a profound statement. I think that a lot of people could really could learn from, because we were taught to be hard on ourselves, you know, and mm-hmm. like to publicly reduce what you have achieved, you know, play yourself down, because we're very afraid of the arrogance thing versus, you know, confidence and, you mm-hmm. know, humbleness. And it's a tough balance. And I think that's really good advice, is to try to help teach people to find joy in the small victories, which yep. probably goes back to like a lot of gratitude focus of just, you know, you have mm-hmm. to be valuing what you're able to do and you're yep. focused on what you do have and what you're able to achieve and the moments you share. You know, I feel like that's a very, like a life perspective more than just a martial art perspective. But as mm-hmm. everybody knows, like life and martial arts kind of intersect where you become more. But, you know, when they're newer to martial arts, people don't really have that all figured out yet, you know, where it's yeah, like, yeah, totally. Oh, I'm trying to learn how to choke people, man. I just want to lose. Like, I just need that. I need to strike. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's all I need. I can remember the last time I coveted a belt was my purple belt. I was in Brazil competing, and I had been just killing it all week. And this tournament was on Saturday, and it was this, in this big arena thing, and everybody was there. And so I was so pumped, and I was like, man, when I win this tournament, I know I'm getting that purple belt. And so I go out, sure enough, man, I lose on points, and I'm just sulking around. I'm up in the stands, just kind of minding my own business. My coach walks by, and he's like, are you okay? And I was like, you know, I'm actually not okay. You know, I really thought this was going to be my purple belt. So I'm like laying it out. And he just looks at me and he goes, yeah, you messed that up, and walks off. Back to exactly what you said, is he minimized what I thought I valued. Was like, uh-huh. yeah, who cares? And he went back to the training. Because like later that day, he's like, man, you had so many good rounds this week, and you learned this, learned that. And like that loss, like, you know, you learned how important the Darce transition was. Like, he just uh-huh. connected some dots, but he minimized the value of that thing that wasn't going to make me happy. You know, like, yeah. you know, that was, and that was the last time I can remember, you know, being very rank focused, you know, maybe a decade ago. But I just, I learned a lot from that. And I think that's very, you know, admirable that you as a coach, like, you're trying to give your students that realistic measurement of like, guys, here's what really matters, which is tough, because some people come in and it's hard to change their value system, because mm-hmm. that's what they've looked at and viewed their whole life. So when you get somebody dug in that's just like their value system is a little bit off, do you encourage books or outside education or things with the training? Like, I mean, how do you help break that belief system sometimes?
You know, I usually use a lot of analogies, and I usually use other athletes that either was too cocky or was not. And I always say, hey, you ever heard of this guy? And they're like, go look him up on the internet and tell me about him tomorrow. Right. And guys will tell me. And I think that's an easier way, because it's a lot faster. And, you know, if you're in jiu-jitsu, you like athletes, and an athletic story is something that you love to hear, right? And so, you know, what happened to, you know, this guy is going to happen to you. It's the same thing. Even if he's the greatest, you got the same thing. It's the same. You're exactly like him. You can learn from his mistake. Go check it out.
Man, that's awesome. So last question is, what match or competition did you have the most fun in? It's like one of your favorite of all time that you're like, oh man, this one time, this match, it's my favorite, win or lose, you know, but just one of your favorite matches, because it was just a unique experience for you. It was like, man, I just loved it.
You know what? I don't remember the guy's name, but it was in my purple belt world championships in Brazil in the finals. The guy was like, I want to say he was 220 pounds absolute. And of course I'm like 180, and this guy was kicking he was killing me. I was 10-0, and then he dislocated my shoulder. And then I went outside, I popped it back in. I remember, you know, Carlos was there. John Machado was there. Higgin Machado was there. And they're my coaches. And I think it was John that said, he goes, Ian, you know, you're down 10-0, second place of the world championships. Absolute is awesome. And I go, no. I still got a little bit of time left. I think I can make it up. And they're like, you're down 10-0. How are you going to make that up? I go, don't worry. I'm going to figure it out a way. And I think that was my best match because I fought all the way to the end. I was in half guard, and I thought I had won them. I thought I already made my comeback, and I thought I already won. And I looked up at the scorecard, and I was like, oh, my gosh, I'm still down 10-9. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I got to get my leg out of here. And I had like 15 seconds to go, and I just did everything. And I even went to the point where if he just buckled me one way, I would have rolled over. But I had myself so overcommitted. And then all of a sudden, he let his legs loose, and he started clapping before the time was up. And in my head, I was like, oh my, like I won that match. And to me, it was the best match because I overcame so many different obstacles. And I felt like this guy felt the same thing. You know, and I know his instructor was the guy Bita, and I still remember. I mean, I've never forget that feeling because this guy, and he was so cool. I mean, after the match, he was more like, "You deserve it here. You got it. It's yours. You want it way more than me." Is the way I felt from him.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, that I'll never forget that match.
Man, that's awesome! An amazing.
And again, it's like it's not about beating that person because I don't even remember his name. It was just the way the match went and what I did within myself to get there is the point.
You expanded as a person, you know, beyond an obstacle that was reasonable. And I think that that's the moment in which people find, you know, a sense of self and like a degree of empowerment is because they're like, I am capable of anything. And those little moments when you show yourself that you're able to do that, it gives you just that extra notch of confidence, like we talked about, of just knowing what you absolutely are capable of. And it starts changing your perspective of how you see the world because things that you never would have imagined or that were out of bounds for you now kind of get in your lane and you're like, no, I can do that as well. Like I can recreate this. And that's
a
beautiful story. I really appreciate it. Thanks for spending time with me today. The story's fun. I really had a good time. Is there anything you'd like to finish with today?
No, I mean, thank you for calling me, and I'm glad we got this done. And you know, jiu-jitsu's been a main part of my life. And like I said, I learned from everyone. And thank you. I hope we run into each other one day.
Absolutely, we will. I appreciate the help today. Great insight, a lot of leadership. People are going to really take a lot from this. Hope everything goes well. You stay safe, and we'll definitely stay in touch.
Okay, take care. Have a good one.